welcome to the teaching. Today's teaching is on Tonglen, which is translated as taking and giving. As always, we go for refuge and set our motivation, our enlightenment thought motivation, before we do any practice. So it's really important that we do that now. Tonglen, which is translated as taking and giving. First of all, I need to clarify that sometimes this gets mistranslated as give and take. Give and take, which is our expression in English, is not the same thing as taking and giving. It's important that we understand that. And then it's good to know that, of course, this teaching originated from Shakyamuni Buddha, but a long time ago this teaching was considered secret. Even today it should only be given to people who are spiritually capable of understanding it. I think there's a couple of reasons why it was secret. First of all, it's a very powerful practice, but it's deceptively simple. And so it could be misunderstood. Powerful tools have their place. You know, a knife in the hands of a surgeon can heal, and a knife in the wrong hands can kill. It is somewhat restricted in that sense because it could be misunderstood. However, I've been asked to give this Tonglen teaching by Lama Jampa. I'll do my best here to try to give the context here. The Tonglen is a type of mind training, the category of teaching called mind training. We need to understand too that when we say mind training, we're not just meaning our discursive mind, our rational mind, our intellectual mind, but we're also including our heart, our compassion, our love, our loving kindness. It's both of those. When we talk about mind training in Buddhism, we're talking about both of those kinds of mind. Tonglen, it needs to be understood to be practiced correctly, and to practice Tonglen correctly, it's important and necessary that we generate bodhicitta first. So what is bodhicitta? Bodhicitta is, it has different translations. I like to translate it as mind of enlightenment. Lama Jampa translates it as bodhi mind. B-O-D-H-I, bodhi mind. Bodhi meaning enlightenment. So it's the mind of enlightenment. So what does that mean to have the mind of enlightenment? This is an extensive topic. I'll just very quickly touch on the main points here. Bodhicitta is actually divided into two types, relative and absolute. And we'll go through what that means. The relative is subdivided into two types, aspiring and entering. What does that mean? When we say we're aspiring, what are we aspiring to? We're aspiring to attain enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. That's our motivation. It's a firm resolve to accomplish that. It's more than just I wish or wishful thinking. And then the entering relative bodhicitta is when we actually go and do it. We actually do the practices which will take us to enlightenment for the sake of all beings. So that's relative bodhicitta. The absolute bodhicitta is the recognition or the accomplishment of the true nature of reality. When the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, came to India 2,600 years ago, he didn't come to found a new religion. He didn't think, oh, I think I'll go to earth and start Buddhism. his quest was in search of the truth. The truth of what? The truth of the nature of reality. And that's what he achieved under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya. When he attained enlightenment, he attained, or he achieved, or he understood the true nature of reality, which is not as it appears to us. So we have the relative truth, which is what we would normally call our normal reality with our bodies and our objects and our world. And according to the Buddha, that is an appearance which is illusory. It isn't the true nature of reality. It appears like a rainbow appears in the sky, but if you go to grab it, it's not there. Or like an image in the mirror appears. If I look in the mirror and I see my face, it looks like I'm in the mirror, but of course I know I'm not in the mirror. I know it's a reflection. It's an appearance. It has the appearance of reality, but it isn't really there. And that's how relative reality appears to us. Absolute reality sees into the depth of the actual situation, which is things appear as the result of an accumulation of aggregates. Causes and conditions come together and they create the appearance of something. But when analyzed through deep insight meditation, it can be seen that that's not the case. So that's a very quick summary of a very deep topic. And in order to generate this mind of enlightenment, we need to start with developing compassion, which then, actually, we can even go before that. We can start at loving kindness, which is the wish for all beings to be happy. And then that generates compassion, seeing that beings are not happy, that we have the wish to free them of their suffering. And not only the wish, but as I said before, we actually take action in order to do that. So there's a step-by-step process, and then the bodhicitta that arrives from the loving kindness and the compassion is what I talked about before. So all of that needs to be generated before we do Tonglen practice. So it's a two-step process. If we jump right into the Tonglen part of the practice without the bodhicitta, we will have zero results. It's an absolute meaningless practice in that sense. The first part of the teaching will be focusing on the development of compassion, loving kindness, bodhicitta, in order to prepare ourselves for the second part, which is the actual Tonglen practice, the actual taking and giving practice, so that it will be effective and produce the result, which is enlightenment for the sake of all beings. There's a lot of different ways we can develop compassion and loving kindness. I have chosen a text by the great Mahasiddha Virupa, which is entitled The Glorious Virupa's Mind Training. And the compassion meditation that Virupa puts in his text is divided into two parts. So today we will do the first part, which is entitled The Yoga of Unparalleled Compassion. The compassion that's talked about by Virupa is actually a one-word summary of the Mahayana Great Vehicle Path. If we wanted to boil it down into one word, it would be compassion, which is the empathy that we feel when we confront another being's suffering. But it goes beyond that in the sense that we want to actually do something, take action to remove the suffering of this suffering being. We feel empathetic, but we're moved to action to help them. If we really look at the situation, we're not very able to help all sentient beings. We don't have the power, as it stands right now anyway. But who does? Well, a Buddha does. Buddha has the power to help sentient beings by showing them the path to enlightenment to be free from suffering. So therefore, our aspiration and our application is focused on the attainment of enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Of course, if we attain enlightenment, we ourselves will also benefit from that. We will be beyond suffering and in a state of continuous bliss. But more than that, we'll be able to show the path skillfully to sentient beings in order to help them attain the same enlightenment. So that's the sequence that we've set out here, and that's the Mahayana approach. The Yoga of Unparalleled Compassion, which is a 14-line mind training by Virupa. Mind trainings very often are very short and concise and pithy, and they quite often need a commentary to unpack the deeper meanings in the text. What we're going to do is we're going to go through Virupa's Yoga of Unparalleled Compassion, and I'm going to add the comments that have been collected from a couple of different masters' commentaries over the centuries. The Yoga of Unparalleled Compassion actually has two different parts to it, two different approaches to the meditation that Virupa offers us. It's our choice how we want to do it. The first technique for meditation that he offers is called the direct approach, or sometimes called the continuum approach. And this is very direct, and it's very powerful, and it's very strong. And when I first received this teaching, because it's first in the text, the teacher gave that as the first teaching. I found it very powerful, almost too powerful. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with the second technique, which is called the rationale, and then we'll go back to the first technique later, and I think it'll be a little bit easier to understand the first technique if we do it this way. The second meditation is a guided meditation, and as I said, it has five parts. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to list and describe the parts, but we're not actually going to go through and do the meditative section on it after the description. But when you're doing the practice, you should do the meditative part of it. Otherwise, it's just a description. The first step is to imagine or remember or conjure up someone who you consider to be your worst enemy and visualize them in front of you. When I first heard this, I thought, well, I'm not sure I have any really enemies, but I certainly have people in my life who create obstacles for me and create trouble. So if you have an enemy, you can visualize them. If not, you can visualize an obstacle, someone who is somehow creating trouble for you in your life. So we visualize that person in front of us, and then we reflect that this person, this enemy, has been my mother in the past. Now, how do we know that? Well, the Buddha taught that the number of sentient beings is infinite. If we look at our world, our universe, all the other universes, all the universes that we don't even know about, and the number of beings in those universes, it's basically uncountable, it's infinite. So that's one aspect to understand. Another aspect is that we are reborn again and again and again. And so the disciples of the Buddha asked the Buddha, since he was clairvoyant, Lord Buddha, if you look back, what was the beginning of your life? What was your first birth? And the Buddha said, I've looked back as far as I can and I see no beginning. So in other words, our rebirths are beginningless. Now, His Holiness Sakyatrichan commented on that. He said, this has to be one of the great mysteries of the universe. So if we combine those two things, that, you know, basically it's beginningless, and we've gone round and round, rebirth, rebirth, and the number of sentient beings is infinite, we could conclude that at some point or another, every sentient being has been our mother. So we're looking at this person who's our enemy, and we're realizing that she was our mother. And what we need to do at that point is to repeat out loud, "Ah, my poor mother," and cultivate compassion towards her repeatedly. And according to the commentary, we need to do this hundreds of times or thousands of times again and again to see that this person who is our enemy has been our mother. And we should say out loud, "Ah, my poor mother." When we recite something out loud, it takes on a certain power. Words have power themselves, but when they're articulated aloud, it's even more powerful. Just think about a poetry reading or Shakespeare or some recitation that you hear verbally. It can be very powerful. And so that's what we want to do, because it affects us in a strong way. So that's the first step. Continuing on, visualizing our enemy in front of us, we ask the question, well, why should I have compassion for her? And the answer is, because she's been my mother not only once or twice, but many, many times. We want to develop compassion again, even deeper, towards her repeatedly, by again saying aloud, "Ah, my poor mother," and saying that again and again and feeling it going in deeper and deeper, that we have this compassion for this person. So that's the second step. The third step is, again, we ask, well, why should I have compassion for her? And the answer that we give ourselves is, every time she was my mother, she showed me immeasurable kindness. And so again, we should repeat, "Ah, my poor mother," and reflect on this and develop compassion repeatedly. Now, sometimes the question is asked, what if I didn't have a mother? Or what if my mother died when I was young? Or what if my mother wasn't a good mother? What if she was abusive or absent or whatever? And I really have a hard time feeling any compassion for somebody like that. Well, there's two responses that teachers give to that. One is, if we think about the precious human rebirth and how difficult it is to obtain, understanding that there are 18 different requirements that have to be met before we can actually say this is a precious human rebirth. It's not enough to just be born human, but you have to fulfill all the other requirements. For example, being exposed to the Dharma is one of them. But the fact that your mother actually carried you and gave birth to you and gave you your human body, okay, your father helped a little bit, but mostly your mother did most of the work. That in itself is something that we should be thankful for and grateful for, but she gave us the chance through giving us life, the chance to become enlightened. Another way of approaching it is to say, well, okay, you didn't have a mother, but somebody raised you, somebody socialized you, somebody taught you how to speak, somebody put you in a position to be whoever you are today. It may have been one person, it may have been more than one person, but somebody in your life did that. So you could choose to visualize that person instead of your mother, if that works better for you. So it depends on your own situation, but you can find some way to do the practice. That's the third one. So the fourth one, again, we ask, why should I have compassion for her? The reply is that, generally speaking, mothers do only beneficial things for their children. When a woman is carrying her child, she pays attention to her diet and her health and sleep and exercise, thinking of the child. And then when the child is born, she's focused completely on that child, taking care of it 24/7. And even if she's not right with the child in that moment, she's thinking about the child. And generally, mothers are totally focused on their child and giving them just incredible benefit constantly, raising them, only thinking of their benefit and almost never thinking of the mother's benefit. However, this person that's visualized in front of us has become misguided. If they are actually harming us, if they are being negative to us, they are creating negative karma for themselves. They've lost their way, so to speak. It's almost as if they've gone a little bit crazy from a spiritual point of view. They've really, as I said, lost their way. And not only that, she's actually harming her child. By harming me, this person who was my mother is harming her child. She's gone against the basic instinct of motherhood there. By reflecting all that, we want to develop deep compassion for her and say again out loud, "Ah, my poor mother." So that's the fourth step. And then the fifth step is, again, we ask, why should I have compassion for her? If she's mistreating me, she's likely mistreating other people too. And this negative activity on her part creates negative karma, which is inescapable for her, unless it's purified through a purification practice. But she will have to experience the negative effects of that karma. And inevitably, she'll be reborn in some sort of suffering, samsaric rebirth. You know, one of the six realms in samsara, they're all suffering realms, and she will be forced to be reborn and suffer in samsara because of her negative action, as we all are. Our karma does not result in anybody else's result. In other words, what we do follows us like our shadow, and what other people do follows them like their shadow, and they don't mix. So she, like all of us, she will be compelled to experiencing the ripening of her negative karma. And again, we say aloud, "Ah, my poor mother." Now, we should be saying this again and again and again and taking time through each of these steps to let it really sink in. I'm just going down the list here to give the sequence of it. When we meditate in this way, so we combine the object, the incantations of "Ah, my poor mother," and then we go through these five rationales for developing compassion. We generate compassion in a very deep way. And if you do this very deeply, the commentaries say that you might find yourself crying. You might have tears in your eyes, and your hair might stand up on your pores. You might have goosebumps. And you might also be... you might also feel a great amount of energy to do this practice. And as a result of that, you will find yourself reflecting, "I will attain Buddhahood for the benefit of all sentient beings, and especially for the perpetrators of harm." And so when we do this practice, it generates the awakening mind, the mind of enlightenment, and we can imagine that all sentient beings, including the perpetrators of harm, that they themselves attain enlightenment, which is our goal. Our goal is to attain enlightenment in order to help other beings attain enlightenment, to repay our mother sentient beings. Once we get to this stage in the meditation, then the wisdom free of conceptual elaboration will spontaneously arise, and we need to place our mind for a long time in that state. Then at the end, of course, we want to dedicate the merit, which is the conclusion of all practices that we do. When we have gone through those steps with our mother as the object, then we can go through the steps, the same procedure, so to speak, again, and we want to extend that out to others. We can replace our mother with our immediate family as the object and go through those steps again. And then we can place our extended family as the object and go through the steps again. And then we place all the people in our city or town as the object and we go through the steps again. And then everybody in our country, and we go through the five steps. And then everybody in the whole world, and then everybody in the universe, and all the universes, and all sentient beings. And so going through those steps, we expand our compassion till it becomes infinite, because the number of beings is infinite. It becomes immeasurable. Becomes immeasurable, and it becomes very deep. And as a result of that, all of our negativity, all of our hatred and our anger and so on, our defilements, obscurations, they naturally diminish. We don't need to work at it. It will just happen naturally if we do this meditation. And not only that, if we have a sickness or an illness, it will subside naturally. If we have a spirit possession, that will subside naturally. So the negativity and the problems that we have will naturally subside. So by focusing on developing compassion for others, we also get the benefit. The Dalai Lama said one time, the most selfish person in the world is someone who's completely altruistic, because they know that by helping and focusing on others, that their own benefit will naturally occur. And not only that, our mind will transform into a natural affection for all beings. And the text says, like a mother's love for her only child. Then finally, if we do this meditation, extraordinary wisdom, free of conceptual elaboration, will arise within us as well. It arises spontaneously. So wisdom is one of our goals. When we attain complete wisdom, we basically are enlightened. This is the first part of the yoga of unparalleled compassion by Virupa, the great master Mahasiddha. So I'm going to stop the teaching at that point, and there will be part two to this teaching. In part two, we will continue with Virupa's text, and we will do the very direct, what's called the direct or the continuum practice, which consolidates all the five steps into one step, and it's very, very powerful. And so we'll continue this text, Virupa's text, and then that will conclude the first part, which is the generation of bodhicitta. And then we will go into the actual Tonglen practice, knowing that we need to develop a lot of compassion and bodhicitta in order for the Tonglen practice to produce its results and benefits, which are vast. And we'll talk about that in the second part of the teaching. Okay, welcome to part two of the Tonglen teaching, taking and giving. As we said last time, in order to practice taking and giving, not only correctly, but also to get the results, we have to be strongly motivated with bodhicitta, or the enlightenment thought. And if we're not, there won't be any result with the taking and giving practice at all. So the first teaching was focusing on that. And I'm not going to redo the teaching, but I will just mention the main points just to bring us up to speed, so to speak. But before I do that, I just want to say a word about preparing. Because normally when we do a practice, in fact, always when we do a practice, we start with refuge and bodhicitta, or the mind of enlightenment. We do the practice and then we finish with dedication. But some teachers emphasize that even before we begin, we really need to have a strong sense of renunciation. Because without renunciation, we really won't have much continuity in our practice. Renunciation is kind of the oomph. It's kind of the switch on our backside to get us practicing. So one way to develop the renunciation is to remember the teaching, the mind training teaching of parting from the four attachments, which we've done here at the center before, but just to review them quickly, this is a teaching that was transmitted from Manjushri to Sakya Kunga Ningpo when he was 12 years old. He was in a retreat. And Manjushri appeared to him and gave him this teaching, which is actually a summary of the whole path, if you can drill down deep enough into it. The teaching is only four lines. The first line is, if you're attached to this life, you're not a spiritual person. What are we mostly attached to? We're mostly attached to this life and all of the things that go with it, like our body, our reputation, our situation in life, and so on and so forth. And if we're really honest, that is really the main thing that grabs most of us. If we let it grab us, if we're attached to it, then we can't really say that we're a spiritual practitioner. The second line is, if you're attached to the samsaric cycle of cyclic existence, you don't have renunciation. So it's kind of self-evident in a way. If I'm attached to samsara, I don't really have a renunciation. Well, you might say, well, why would anybody be attached to samsara? Well, there are some people who practice with the aim of having a higher rebirth. They want to have a better situation next time around, and that's as far as their motivation goes. The third line is, if you're attached to your own self-interest, you don't have the mind of enlightenment. And that's really key for this discussion about taking and giving, because the whole practice of taking and giving is about freeing ourselves from self-cherishing, which is the main demon that haunts us. And then the fourth line, if grasping arises, there is not the correct view. So that refers to the wisdom teachings on emptiness and dependent arising. So those are the four lines of parting from the four attachments. So even before we sit down and start our practice with refuge and so on, it's good to really have those four lines or something similar in our awareness. So just to make a very quick review of what we talked about in the first teaching, I'll just go sort of point by point. Last time we actually did a meditation at each point to have a little bit of an experience of it. All of these points that I'm going to go through here, we're not going to do the meditation, but they are meditation topics that are to be meditated on at length, repeatedly, okay? The first point is recognizing that all sentient beings have been our mother. And the reasoning there is that time is beginningless, rebirth is beginningless, sentient beings are infinite. So at some point or another, going round and round in this sort of infinite circle, every single sentient being has been my kind mother. And we meditate on that. The second point is to recognize, well, they're suffering. They're in samsara. I can see they're suffering. All you have to do is look at beings, and it's pretty evident that sentient beings suffer. And not only that, but because they were my kind mother, I must help them. What kind of person would ignore their suffering mother? We meditate on that point. And by the way, with every point, we recite aloud, may the suffering of all beings fall on me. This is another topic we'll get into a little bit more later. But one of the things we talked about in the previous teaching was this practice of saying the phrases aloud, out loud. There's a certain effect, there's a certain result that happens when we use words. Words are powerful, and if you can say them out loud, it has a different impact on your mind, different result. So my mothers are suffering. I must help them. But really, what can I do? My power is really limited. I can't really help all sentient beings. Well, who can? A fully enlightened Buddha can, by showing the way to enlightenment. So I will become a Buddha in order to do that. Okay, how do I do that? How do I become a Buddha? In very simplistic terms, it entails the defeat of the demon of self-cherishing. That has been identified as the main problem. And it's that which causes our ignorance, which causes our defilement, which causes bad karma, which causes suffering and the cycle of samsara. So we want to focus on defeating the demon of self-cherishing. So how do I do that? The way to do that is through the development of the mind of enlightenment, commonly known as bodhicitta. I need to grow it. I need to develop it. I need to cultivate it. There are steps to do that. And again, each step is a meditation that's to be repeated over and over again. So the first step in the development of the mind of enlightenment is to recognize the equality of self and others. I want to be happy, so does everybody else. I don't want to suffer, neither does anybody else. And not only people, but animals and all beings. That's just the way it is, that we're all equal in that sense. And then the next step, if we visualize ourselves on one side of the balance and all sentient beings on the other side, it seems a little bit imbalanced, doesn't it? And what we want to do to take our spiritual development further is we want to exchange those two. And this is a big leap forward spiritually. It's counterintuitive to value others more than we value ourselves because, as we said before, we were mostly attached to our own situation, our own selves, literally. So the meditation on exchanging is the next step. And if you really want to go in deep into that practice, how do you do that? Tonglen. Okay, the taking and the giving. And as we mentioned last time, it's not giving and taking. It's taking and giving. And I point that out because that's a mistake. To say give and take is not correct. Give and take is something different than taking and giving. Anyway, without getting sidetracked on that, Tonglen, or taking and giving, is how we're going to develop what we just went through. And I will go into the benefits of it later, and the benefits are extensive. But right now, that is the point-by-point summary of what we covered last time. With any luck, that'll eventually be available, the audio recording. Tonglen, a lot of people have heard about it, but not everybody has really gone into the depth of how do you do it really deeply. I know when I was first taught it, I was just taught the mechanics of it, which is actually very simple. You see, Tonglen is a little bit deceptive because the mechanics are really simple, but the practice itself is really deep and powerful, and originally it was secret. The mechanics are, at least the way I was taught, was it was just simply breathing in negativity as black smoke through your left nostril, which goes down into your heart, destroys your self-cherishing, and then you exhale out your right nostril, light. And that's it. That's simple. Seen that way, it doesn't seem like much. In fact, it seems kind of odd in a certain sense. Why would I even want to do that? If we go back to this idea that I want to exchange self and others, that I really want to put myself in a position to be able to help others, I need to be able to take away their suffering. Right? So the mechanics of breathing in black smoke and breathing out white light is just a didactic tool to learn how to do it. The real practice is I need to change my mind. So this is a kind of a first step to get us going in it. And then as we do it, we develop the actual mind training part of it. It isn't just breathing the smoke and blowing out light, you know. It's an actual mind training. So let's go into a little more detail about how to do this. Not the mechanics part, but the mind change part. By the way, the light you send out is the rays of morning sunlight, pristine. We'll start with the taking part. Okay, so what are we taking? My first teacher, Geshe Tashi Namgyal, used to say, well, look at yourself and see what is your worst affliction. You know, be honest. What's the thing I need to work on the most, and then work on that. For example, let's take this, you know, we have lots of afflictions that we can choose from, but just for example, let's say that my worst affliction is aversion. And I'm really afflicted by aversion, you know, this kind of being put off and distancing, putting people and things far away. Okay, I don't like it, so I'm going to put it out of my environment. However we manifest our aversion. But let's just say, for example, that's my worst affliction. So then when we breathe in, we take all of the aversion that sentient beings have, all of the suffering that comes from aversion, and we take that in, we bring it in, as we said, into our heart to destroy our self-cherishing. So whatever it is that I'm suffering from, I can take that as my object, so to speak. But that's just an example. I could also, like in my case right now, my main problem is chronic pain. So what do? I take in all the pain, all the suffering that people have from pain, and I take that on. I say, may it all come to me. My poor suffering mother's, I will relieve them. Or disease. There's plenty of that going around. Maybe I'm suffering from some disease. I mean, we all get sick from time to time, but maybe I have something that's really, you know, serious, my main problem. Okay, I'm going to take on all the disease that people are suffering from. I'm going to take it on. Why? Because I've taken the bodhisattva vow to attain enlightenment for the sake of all beings. I can't abandon them. That's part of my vow. Or I could take on negativity. There's plenty of that. You know, we're in a Kali Yuga, a dark age. No shortage of that. I can take on all the world's negativity, all the sentient beings' negativity. I can take that on. Sorrow. I got a phone call today from someone whose brother is dying a terrible death, and she's really, really, really sad about it. Take that on. You know? Spirit possessions. People can have, beings can have big problems with spirit possessions, physical and mental problems. Now, some people don't, especially in the West, some people don't believe in spirits or spirit possessions. It's not scientific. You can't measure it. You can't see it. You can't, you know. But as you get into meditation and as you get into practicing, you know, there are spirits and they can make a lot of trouble. And some people succumb to that and they end up being negatively affected by a spirit possession. So we can take that on. All the people that have, you know, a lot of what we call mental illness is spirit possession. Elemental imbalances. Now, the topic of elements is a big topic, and we could spend days on that. But if we wanted to just talk about it in real simplistic terms, if we said a person was really angry all the time, they're always just really, really mad about something, we could say, well, they have too much fire. Or if a person is overly emotional, they're always crying and they're always blown away and they're just like water imbalance. If someone is, they think too much, they talk too much, they're hyper, they're always, you know, the famous monkey mind, you know, air imbalance. Or if somebody's really lethargic, too much, they're lazy, they can't get up, they can't get motivated, they can't get going, earth imbalance, and so on. So if we know somebody's like that, or we're like that, we can take on the environmental imbalances. Another way to do it is to think about the beings in the six realms and what kind of suffering do they have in each realm. So the hell beings, they obviously have extreme suffering of a hot or cold and other things. The hungry ghosts have incredible hunger and physical suffering, like fire in their body and things like that, and long, long lifetimes of that. We get into the human realm, birth, old age, sickness and death, poverty, bodily defects of various kinds. The asuras are consumed by jealousy and anger. And the god realms, it looks good, but what do they suffer from? Impermanence. It ends. And then there's nowhere to go but down. And they have a really, really heavy fall when they are reborn, in that process of being reborn. So if we want to go through the six realms, we can take on those sufferings from the beings that are in them, in those realms. And remember, those beings are all our mothers. Right? This is not just some unknown being. So those are ways that we could take on. We can also take on obstacles to enlightenment. There's lots of those, especially in a degenerate age. Maybe we don't have enough money to go get a teaching, or maybe we're troubled by, you know, physical problems, family problems, sickness problems, and it interferes with our practice. Or maybe our teacher moved away and we don't have any more contact with them. There's all kinds of obstacles to enlightenment that can happen and do happen. The list of suffering goes on and on. Those are just some examples, just to give you an idea in case you need it. Whatever it is that we're taking on, we want to concentrate our body, speech, and mind single-pointedly to collect those sufferings onto ourselves. We're going to take it on. We're going to take the responsibility leading to enlightenment, all sentient beings. So we have to take away their suffering to do that. The text that we used last week to develop bodhicitta was a text from Virupa, the famous Mahasiddha Virupa. And there were commentaries over the centuries written about his teaching, which was only 14 lines. It was a pithy mind training. So there's commentaries to, you know, flesh it out, so to speak. And one of the commentaries that I have said that at this point, you should meditate between 1 and 3 hours on each one of these. Well, that was written in the 12th century for monastics that didn't do anything else except practice. So to do a 1 hour or 3 hour practice in a monastery, even today, is not unusual. But for those of us that are not in that kind of situation, we have to adapt. We have to be practical. Because if we say we're going to sit down and do it for 3 hours, we might do it, but we probably wouldn't do it very often, because that's quite a big chunk of time for most of us to take aside and actually sit still one-pointedly and do. So we have to adjust to our own situation. We have to be practical. We have to be realistic. But we can't use that as an excuse not to practice at all. Because if you don't practice, you don't get the result. And right now, we're just going round and round in samsara. In any case, we do the best we can with what we've got and what our situation is, hopefully motivated by the renunciation that we developed in the beginning. But if we do this, if we do this practice diligently and for a long time, we can actually cure ourselves of sickness. We can actually cure others of sickness. That's not out of the realm of possibility if you do this well and often enough. But in any case, we want to be reciting every step of the way, may the suffering of all sentient beings fall on me. We want to say that aloud.
May the suffering of all beings
fall on me. As I said, this is counterintuitive. We don't normally go around looking for suffering. And some people might say, well, wait a minute, that's scary. If I say that and believe it and do it, it might actually happen. I might actually have to deal with all this suffering that's coming on to me. I am asking for it, one pointedly. And that's, I think, a natural reaction to think, whoa, wait a minute. And Sakyapandita, of course, heard this objection. And he said, well, first of all, don't worry about it. It's not going to happen. It's like going into the middle of a woods or a forest with some pots and pans and a ladle and making a big bang, bang, bang noise in the forest and say, okay, all you wild animals, come here. I want to talk to you. Bang, 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 bang. Well, the wild animals aren't going to come to you. They're going to scatter, right? Normally. And he said, you should think about it that way. There is no way that you're going to get anything negative coming out of this, even though the appearance is that you're taking on negativity and suffering. The result is actually the opposite. This is where we're making a leap into what I would say a pretty advanced practice, because it requires a genuine change in your mind, which is what we want. That's the whole reason we're doing this, is to, it's called mind training. It's true that if I go out to a field and take on the suffering of the cows, they're still going to be cows. It's not going to change. The cows are still going to be cows. But what has changed is my mind. And that's what we're working with here. Eventually, I'll be able to help the cows. So all of that is the instruction on taking. So now we go to the other side, the giving side. Again, sending out rays of morning sunlight through our right nostril. So what are we giving? There's a tradition in the Sutrayana of giving your body. And we can read about great saints who gave their bodies or parts of their bodies in terms of being super generous. That kind of giving of your body is not recommended until you're at a very, 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 very high spiritual level. For regular folks like us, we shouldn't do that. Okay, if somebody doesn't have a hand, we don't cut off our hand and give it to them. That's what bodhisattvas did in the past, but we don't do that. You can give your body in other ways. You can give whatever help you can give with somebody that needs help. Again, we're visualizing it. Okay, so we can give our body, we can give our material resources, whatever we have, how much we have. Sometimes people say to me, well, how much should I give? And I say, well, if you have a lot, give a lot. If you don't have a lot, give what you can give. So the idea is we're going to be giving our resource. What else do we have that we can give? Well, we have positive karma. The fact that we're doing a very advanced practice like this means we have some really nice positive karma. So you can give that away. You can give away your meritorious virtue. That's probably the most important thing we have in a way, because as we've learned in other teachings, the accumulation of meritorious virtue is how we attain the realization of wisdom, which is, in effect, enlightenment. So there's this progression of we practice, we accumulate virtuous merit, but then we give it away. And so on and so on. So there's all kinds of good things that we have that we can think about. And then while we're giving these things, whatever they are, away, we recite aloud, may all sentient beings obtain the three bodies of a Buddha. So that's our aspiration. That's our recitation. What does that mean to say that I aspire that beings obtain the three bodies of a Buddha? The discussion of the Buddha's bodies is pretty extensive. You could approach it from the point of view that the Buddha has two bodies, the Buddha has three bodies, the Buddha has four bodies. Each one approaching it from a different angle, so to speak, like the facets on a diamond. So in this case, the commentaries suggest the recitation of may all sentient beings obtain the three bodies of a Buddha. What are the three bodies? You have the what's called the truth body, or the Dharmakaya, which is the highest mode of existence, you could say, which is beyond words, which is totally blissful, and which is beyond description of any kind. And Buddhas have that, but then when Buddhas see suffering, because Buddhas see all sentient beings all the time, and they know their situation in their minds, when the conditions are ripe, which is usually means when the sentient being has enough merit, the Buddha will manifest to benefit that being. Right? If there isn't any merit, there's no point in manifesting because there won't be any result. The Buddha can't make you enlightened. He can show you the way, but we have to do the work. But if the situation calls for it, the Buddha can then manifest in an infinite number of ways into these other two bodies. So the second body would be what's called the enjoyment body, Sambhogakaya. And this is a very special body which is manifested or emanated to teach the very, 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 very advanced bodhisattvas that are on the very last rung of the bhumis, or the grounds. They're in the final stages before enlightenment, but they still need to finish that last step. But the only being qualified to be their guru is a Buddha, because they're above everybody else, so to speak, spiritually on the scale. So the Buddha manifests to those beings in this body, the enjoyment body. And when we see tankas of Chenrezig and Manjushri and Vajrapani, that's the form they take. That's where those forms come from. Chenrezig, the compassion Buddha, okay. That's the second kind of body. And then the Nirmanakaya, the emanation body, is the body that the Buddha emanates in whatever realm is necessary for him to go to help sentient beings. So, for example, Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha that walked in India 2,600 years ago, he was an emanation. But the Buddhas also emanate to the other realms, to the animal realms, to the hungry ghost realms, anywhere they're needed out of compassion, when the conditions are favorable. So our recitation aloud is, may all sentient beings attain the three bodies of a Buddha. Because that's how Buddhas can actually help us. They can't make us enlightened, but they can show us the path. All of that practice up until now with the giving and the taking and the giving is what we would call relative level. It's the relative bodhicitta. But there is also the absolute. When we talk about absolute bodhicitta, we're talking about the wisdom of emptiness, the wisdom of dependent arising. It's because of dependent arising and emptiness that beings can change into Buddhas from sentient beings. Otherwise, we'd just be stuck wherever we were or are. So this is a really important part of the practice. It's called the absolute enlightenment thought. So what we want to do at this point is we want to visualize our mother sentient beings transforming into a Buddha meditational deity. So, like, for example, Chenrezig. in the transformation, they lose whatever material body they have and become a light body. So the body is translucent, it's transparent, actually, from the inside and the outside. So it's not solid, you know, like our body, but it's like a light body. And we visualize that process happening, our mothers transforming into Buddhas. And because of the law of impermanence, that's possible. If there wasn't impermanence, it wouldn't be possible, right? And at that point, we change our recitation to become, how wonderful if all sentient being mothers could attain the state of an enlightened Buddha. Wouldn't that be great? That's our wish, but we say it out loud as we visualize this, okay? When we do an absolute enlightenment thought practice, we have the appearance, so we have the visualization of the mother transformed into the meditational Buddha, but we also want to make sure that we seal it with emptiness. Well, what does that mean? It means that the appearance and the inherent emptiness are inseparable. So the famous Heart Sutra, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Okay? We want to make sure that we seal our practice. If we don't, it's not perfect practice. So that needs to be always there. Okay? And again, these are very advanced practices that are repeated again and again. We're going to get to the benefits in a minute. But before that, if we do all this up till now, then we settle our mind. We settle our mind free of thought and free of conceptual elaboration. So we don't visualize the deity and think, oh, I really like that color red. No, I think the nose is too big. It ought to be a little smaller. Or no, it's really pretty skin. You know, like we don't conceptualize and analyze and judge and discursive talk about it. But we settle our mind in a free, open state, free of thoughts and free of elaboration. And we remain in that state for as long as we can. And then when the conceptual thoughts start to arise, when we get tired or we start to sort of lose our meditative object, then we conclude the meditation, we do our dedication like we always do at the end of all practices. Why? Because we've developed a whole bunch of merit and we're going to share it, because that's the whole idea, right? And that is how to practice the Tonglen in a way where we really can produce the results and get the benefits, which we're going to talk about now. We have immediate benefits and we have long-term benefits. In the immediate benefits, all of this practice that we've been talking about, if we do it well and correctly, it enhances our compassion and it helps our spiritual progress. We talked about last time about how compassion really is a one-word summary of the Mahayana Great Vehicle Path. So we really want to be focused on that. And this does it. This develops our compassion. And it really catapults our spiritual practice dramatically when we do this. That's one benefit. Another benefit is all of our negativity, all of our negative thoughts and processes and afflictions subside. That all goes down. So even though we're focused on sentient beings, it's benefiting us. Okay? And this is one of the way it benefits us, is our afflictions go down, they subside. And as I mentioned earlier, if you do it well enough and you're sick, you can cure yourself. If you do it really well enough, you can cure others. Another benefit, as we already mentioned, is the release of spirit possessions. So if you or someone you know is suffering from that and you do this, you can actually take away that spirit possession. I actually saw that happen one time. And these spirit possessions, some of them can even affect generationally. So that gets into the family and affects a whole family. You might know families that have lots of mental health problems. That can be from this. And this practice can remedy that. In summary, you become beneficial to all sentient beings through doing this. You can benefit sentient beings by influencing them positively. And in another teaching that we did here at the center not too long ago, there are teachings about how to spiritually benefit beings. There's a list of four things you can do. One of them is to simply give material objects. So when I first met my first teacher, Geshe-Tashi Namgyal, very shortly after I met him, he gave me a mala, a rosary. And I was ecstatic. I didn't expect that. And I cherished that for a long time. And it was just a very simple wooden mala that didn't cost very much. But it was a physical object that he gave me that made a connection that kind of hooked me a little bit. It kind of drew me in a little bit. And that's one of the things you can do. That's one of these four things you can do. Another technique, according to the text, actually by Sakya Pandita, is to speak pleasantly, specifically about Dharma. That doesn't mean to proselytize or, you know, pound the person, but if they're open, then you begin to talk about Dharma in a way that's appropriate for them and wherever they're at, in a kind of pleasant way. A third thing that's listed in the teaching is to give encouragement. So when somebody's practicing, when they've become a practitioner, support them in whatever way possible. Encourage them, or if you can, maybe sponsor them in a retreat or something, you know, like whatever you can do according to the circumstances to encourage them in their practice. And then the fourth thing you can do is set a good example. Not do as I say, do as I do, right? So if you're preaching and saying do this, do that, and you're not doing anything, that doesn't really, you know, cut it. So that's the most important one, maybe. But anyway, those are the things you can do according to the teachings you can do. So those are influences that you can have on sentient beings. Again, we're in the relative benefits here. So another relative benefit is it creates the causes for the enjoyment body and the emanation body. So remember the three bodies, those are the second and the third. So on the relative level, this practice creates the causes for those two bodies, the enjoyment body and the emanation body. I try to use the English terms because Sanskrit is kind of far away for most of us. So that's a benefit of the relative enlightenment thought practice. Another benefit is you can attain the sign of calm abiding and special insight. So calm abiding is a meditative achievement or accomplishment which refers to not only the ability to meditate and to focus, not for an hour or a day or a week, but indefinitely. But even beyond that, there is a bliss which overwhelms you when you attain the complete achievement of calm abiding. So it's the combination of infinite focus and bliss is what we call calm abiding. And then that can be applied to the practice of special insight. When you do this taking and giving well, you can have the attainment of calm abiding and special insight. Those are very high attainments, okay? Those are signs of your practice being done right. Another sign is becoming free of the subject-object dualism that we're all caught up in. I, me, mine, you, they, and the separation those are benefits of the relative side of it. And then we have the benefit of the ultimate attainment, which is the first body, the truth body, the Dharmakaya. And this practice done well leads to a spontaneous path to enlightenment. So this practice itself is a path to enlightenment. I'm not saying it's the only path, but it is a definite path. But it needs to be done with all these pieces that we've talked about, with the renunciation and the enlightenment thought and the taking and the giving and the verbalization and all of that. It's a very advanced practice which appears to be deceptively simple because of the mechanics of it. And then, of course, as always, you end with your dedication. So that is how to practice taking and giving in a two-step process. Questions, comments?
I had a question. You know, when we started off, you talked about breathing in, you know, dark smoke and exhaling light and giving and taking. Does that mean that there's a connection there, like to pranayama? You know, in like we don't really, I guess we don't really know where Tonglen came from, but
came from the Buddha.
Yeah, it seems to me that there's a little bit of. It seems like there's a practice behind this, like an actual, you know, like a completion stage practice, maybe, you know.
Okay, it's true that it appears like a pranayama practice. But it isn't really, in the sense that smoke and light part is, as I said, it's just a didactic tool to teach you how to get into it, so to speak. Really, the practice is about changing your mind state to kill the demon of self-cherishing, or dissolve it, maybe. I personally think this isn't that well understood, at least in the West anyway, because I certainly didn't understand it until I dove into it and started practicing it, actually. Because I just thought it was breathing in smoke and sending out light, and, oh, that's nice, have a nice day, let's sing Kumbaya, but I never really had any connection to it. Mm-hmm. It was only when I started studying it and practicing it, because I had chronic pain, that I started to see the depth of it, and I think that's one of the reasons that Lama asked me to teach this, is so that we could get into this a little more, in more detail and more depth. Because if you don't have the first part, you're wasting your time with the second part. It isn't going to happen. Quite a bit here. I think if you remember, I'm just running through it. Each one of these is a meditation you do, and you do it repeatedly. In fact, if you remember from the first class, the text said, do it thousands or hundreds of thousands of times each step.
So the, you know, inhaling the smoke or the dark light or however you describe it, and then exhaling this beautiful, lucid sunshine, that is the method for feeling what it is that people are suffering and returning a sense of bliss and happiness and ease to beings. And it's just like the visual form that we use, and it's not so much focusing on the channels going down like that or anything like that. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. That's maybe you could call it a warm-up. Get you into that rhythm and that practice, and after you do it a while, you don't need to smoke. You're taking in the whatever you're taking in. Because you're focusing on that.
Yeah. I was wondering something, and I'm sorry if it sounds like it's kind of a completely sideways question, but when you were talking about spirit possessions, and I don't necessarily know anybody with a spirit possession, but I was thinking the spirit that is possessing the person is itself a mother sentient being.
Yeah.
So in order to perform the spirit, to try to release that suffering, you're not just perhaps taking in the suffering of the person who's possessed, but also the spirit who is trying to gain happiness through possessing somebody else.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're taking in both of these sufferings and hopefully releasing that spirit suffering so it goes away.
This is.
But I don't know. I'm just asking if that's how it would work.
Yeah, you know, I think this is a little bit unique to Buddhism in a way. I mean, we have compassion for the victim. But we also should have compassion for the perpetrator too.
Sure.
In fact, in some ways, they're in a worse state.
Yeah.
No, but even if it's just two people and one of them's beating the other, in general, that it's easy to have empathy for the victim.
Yes.
But we don't always have empathy and compassion for the perpetrator.
Right.
Right? But if we look at it from a Dharma point of view, the perpetrator is actually in a worse situation. Because the victim, even though they're suffering, they're eliminating that negative karma which caused that suffering in the first place. And if they don't react, that's why you shouldn't react. If they don't react, it's finished, it's gone.
Right.
Whereas the perpetrator, they're creating suffering for themselves by hurting the other person. They're creating the negative karma which is going to come around and they're going to be the victim.
Right.
So they're afflicted. And they're trapped by the negative karma, so to speak.
Yeah.
Whereas the victim, if they don't react, can be freed from the negative karma. So really, we should have at least as much compassion for the perpetrator as we have for the victim. That's equanimity.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. And it can be hard. But it's so important to recognize that at least up here. And then hopefully, hopefully we get it in here too.
And to take it one step further, we're talking as if we're the third person looking on from the outside. But if you're the victim, and we're getting beaten or whatever, abused or whatever, that's when you really need to practice compassion.
True.
And say, this person's nuts, they're crazy, they're really making trouble for themselves, and I'm actually fortunate that I'm getting rid of my negative karma by them beating me.
Right.
That's a step. I mean, that's a leap. But that's the dharmic step.
Yes.
And if, on the other hand, we react as the victim, well, guess what? If I'm going to react and beat them back, then I'm creating the negative karma again going the other way, which is what started this whole thing in the first place. And not only that, they'll probably retaliate even more and beat me even more, so I'm causing them to create non-virtue, and I'm creating this huge mess by reacting.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, Jesus said, turn the other cheek, which sounds kind of silly, but in a way, looking at it from this point of view, it makes sense.
Mm.
I'm not saying it's easy, but that's the practice, you know? I had a situation myself, personally, when I was riding the bus here, and the bus was jam-packed, rush hour, and I was sitting. There were lots of people standing, and I was in one of the sideways seats.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a guy standing right in front of me, a young guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a moment, and he started screaming at me, and he got right in my face, started spitting in my face, and screaming at the bus, saying, look at this guy, he's a horrible person. And he was just going nuts, and he was like this far away from my face.
Right.
I was sitting. I'm 75. He was 20.
Right.
And I was in one of those moments when I could have gone either way. I mean, I wasn't going to do that, but fortunately had enough to just sit there and be calm. And he ranted and ranted, and everybody was looking, and the bus was full, and we're sitting there, and he's ranting and spitting and yelling. And fortunately, there was a young guy on the bus, he was a bodhisattva, who came over and intervened and said to the guy, listen, it's okay, man, just chill out. You know, why don't you take a few steps back? And he separated us physically.
Oh, wow. Great.
Yeah, he saved me. I didn't know him. He's just some guy, you know, some another young guy who intervened and said, oh, it's okay, man, don't worry, to this other guy, right?
Yeah.
And so at that point, this guy moved away, and I had a chance to get up, and I got off at the next stop, which wasn't my stop. But the point I'm saying is that because of Dharma, I had it together enough for, you know, it seemed like forever. It was probably 30 seconds or something, you know, to not react.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens when you don't react is it dissipates.
Yes. Yeah.
If you react, it's pouring gas on the fire.
For sure.
So hopefully we don't have too many of those experiences, but it's good to be able to handle it and to know, oh, don't react, you know. Sometimes doing nothing is the best.
Thank you. That's a really good illustration.
Okay, any other comments or questions?
Just thank you, yeah.
Yeah,
thank you.
It's very thorough.
Yeah, so you now have a practice that I don't think many Westerners have, really. Mm-hmm. I don't know how much detail this gets, you know, disseminated, so to speak.
Sure.
Okay, let's say our dedication. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May defeat the enemy of wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious. May it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen. May it never decline where it has arisen, but ever grow and flourish. In whatever way valiant Manjushri and Samantabhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all my own virtues that I might train to be like them. Through this dedication, praise the Supreme, by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future, I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever little virtue I may have gained by prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment. Thank you.
I think that's helpful.